Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we talk about the Tumblr Ridge tragedy, youth radicalization, and transphobia on Bubble Pop. Banter about Bad Bunny, the Super Bowl, and the 2026 Winter Olympics on The End of Sport, and discuss the RCMP versus Canadian journalism on the North State. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage Podcast. Based in Calgary, this collective of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a December 2020 episode, Team Advantage explore the events surrounding 1983's Operation Solidarity, one of the largest political protests in British Columbia history. Now, here's the show.
We are solidarity. There's an anger.
Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. Check out our partner shows at harbingermedianetwork.com. This independent listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage. Hello and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I am your host, Kate Jacobson, and today's episode is going to be about one of British Columbia's largest mass mobilizations and the largest general strike in modern history that didn't quite happen. We are going to be talking today about Operation Solidarity and the summer and fall of 1983 in British Columbia, because I guess this isn't even really a podcast about Alberta anymore. It's just a podcast about things we find interesting. Joining Team Advantage today, we have Joel.
Hello, hello.
Karen.
Howdy.
And Patrick.
Thanks for having me in. Hello from Victoria.
So to get us started about what happened in 1983, it's probably worth taking a bit of a quick look at what happened in British Columbia since the last time we talked about the province. And our last look was a fairly recent episode about Dave Barrett's NDP government, which governed from 1972 to 1975. And to sum it up quickly, they basically implemented an impressive number of progressive reforms, but in their final year in 1975, they also implemented some sweeping back-to-work legislation to, quote, resolve a number of private sector strikes. Pierre Elliott Trudeau's federal liberals actually implemented similar changes days later with their Anti-Inflation Act, as well as wage and price controls. For some reason, strike-breaking back-to-work legislation did not sufficiently mobilize British Columbians to secure another election win for the NDP. They held on to their vote share in 1975, but in many races, a combined opposition, so no Liberal or PC candidates, meant that Social Credit was able to secure more seats. It's also worth pointing out here that that this is a time of great inflation, sparked in part by the energy crisis of the 70s. And inflation basically means that people's wages are not keeping up with increasing costs. So in trying to increase wages through strikes, workers are increasingly finding governments basically limiting their ability to strike, as well as how much they can ask for. So this is a microcosm of sort of the overall breakdown of the Keynesian welfare state that is happening in the 70s. It's also worth pointing out that the early 1980s are really bad for British Columbia because its economy was based on resource exports. So you get a recession and you also get a collapse of prices for raw materials. So BC's unemployment rate actually goes from 7% in 1981 to 12% in 1982 and then up to 15% in 1984.
In power in British Columbia for the next while is the Social Credit Party, headed up by Bill Bennett. If that name seems familiar, it's because it's W.A.C. Bennett's son. W.A.C., or Wacky, as we like to call him, Bennett, had been the social credit premier of British Columbia for 20 years, from 1952 until 1972, and now his son is premier after that brief NDP interruption. Wow, I love democracy.
Two elections happened between 1975 and the events of Operation Solidarity in 1983. In 1979, Social Credit wins another majority, with the NDP gaining some ground in that they increased their share of the popular vote and gained some more seats. There's another election in May of 1983, and in labor circles, it was believed that the NDP would win because Social Credit had proved itself really quite unpopular. During this election campaign, however, the big brain trust of the NDP strategists developed the theory that the election would be won or lost on the votes of about 5% of the electorate that hadn't made up its mind either way. Yay, swing voters. What a great group to be aiming for. So these are the so-called undecideds. Chasing the middle in an effort to get these swing votes, the NDP made themselves look quote-unquote safe and similar to the Conservatives, assuming that their locked-in voters had nowhere else to go. Speaking about whether or not the NDP, if elected, would undo the wage stabilization efforts that Social Credit had brought in, headed in a commission headed up by Ed Peck, Dave Barrett responded, let's face it, I've been premier before, and if I go back again, I don't want people to think it's going to be miracle time. It's going to be tougher to getting wage increases with us than it was with Peck.
So the NDP campaigned on being tougher on public sector labor than Social Credit was. In any case, the NDP lost the election, losing about 1% of the popular vote compared to the 1979 election, losing four seats, which Social Credit gained to form yet another Social Credit majority. Bennett interpreted this narrow election victory on May 5th, 1983, as a mandate for restraint.
So on July 7th, 1983, the Social Credit government introduces a budget bill alongside 26 bills outlining radical changes to government services and labor rights. You may recall that the Fraser Institute had been founded in 1974 as a kind of reaction to Dave Barrett's NDP government, and it's been pumping out free market libertarian policy recommendations at this point for 9 years. A number of the recommendations are now being directly implemented as bills proposed by the Social Credit government.
This policy that's been brought in, this package of legislation that takes apart one piece of society after another, is not just the invention of Bill Bennett's crazed "it came from Kelowna" mind, but these are the policies that a lot of powerful organizations in British Columbia society have advocated for years, have financed with a lot of their hard unearned money, and have backed and have called for. So Bennett is carrying out the program of powerful organizations in British Columbia, and there's no mystery about who these organizations are. They're the BC Employers Council, they're the BC Chamber of Commerce, they're the Federation of Independent Businessmen, BC Branch, the Vancouver Stock Exchange, the Board of Trade, and the list goes on and on, including landlords associations, the Association of Automobile Dealers, every two-bit contractor who doesn't want a union worker on the job. That's an organized force in society, and that, I think, is who Solidarity is really fighting.
And these bills, very broadly, basically aim to undermine the practices of trade unions and the status of collective bargaining more generally, as well as abolishing kind of watchdog-type bodies and things like the Human Rights Commission and Code, things like that. They're also aiming, of course, to cut services and centralize authority in the hands of the government. As an example of some of these things, we've got Bill 2, the Public Service Labor Relations Amendment. This removed government employees' rights to negotiate anything except wages, and government employees were organized in the British Columbia Government Employees Union, or BCGEU. This is the largest union in British Columbia. There also is Bill 3, the Public Sector Restraint Act, which enabled employers in the public sector to fire employees upon the expiration of a collective agreement. So essentially getting rid of job security. You've also got Bill 11, the Compensation Stabilization Amendment Act. This handled the wage issue by extending previously established public sector wage controls, and it also limited bargaining to a minus 5% to plus 5% range when it looked at wages. Bill 5 is the Residential Tenancy Act. This abolished the rentalsman's office and rent controls. Vancouver, of course, has historically had one of the lowest vacancy rates in Canada, and renters have long suffered there at the hands of landlords, so fortunately, nothing has changed. There was a lot of widely circulated reports of rent increases at the time, rent increases of 49% to about 100%. And Consumer and Corporate Affairs Minister Jim Hewitt actually indicated that he would allow a blacklisting service for landlords to operate as long as it met the requirements of the Credit Reporting Act. And then last but not least, you've also got Bill 27, the Human Rights Act. This repealed the Human Rights Code, narrowed the definition of discrimination, and limited the amount of compensation you could receive through the Human Rights Commission, as well as abolishing it.
So while restraint and balanced budgets were the excuses used for these changes, actual spending in this period went up 12%, and the deficit actually increased by $1.6 billion. And so, like with a lot of these things, we have to recognize it's not about the budget. The budget is always sort of a distraction to get people willing to vote for these things. What it's really about is changing the structure of the economy in the long term to favor capital and enable it to evade the barriers of higher wages, the higher wages of unionized labor, and as well to avoid the taxes that form the basis for the minimum you get from the welfare state. So the aim is to bring wages down and lower the basic minimum standard people can expect to get when times are tough, all to make things friendlier for capital investment. The earliest responses to all of this budget bullshit comes from the Vancouver and District Labor Council, and particularly the Labor Council's Unemployment Committee. Yeah, for real, the Labor Council had an unemployment committee. Awesome. With 2 days' notice, they organized a demonstration on Monday, July 11th, with representatives of 50 organizations, advocacy groups, unions, political bodies, and the like. And the organizers didn't have enough room in the hall for everyone that showed up.
That same day, July 11th, the BC Federation of Labor calls a press conference stating that the BCFL will be leading a major campaign of opposition to the budget. The next day, July 12th, hundreds attend a forum addressed by members of the about-to-be-abolished Human Rights Commission. 24 hours later, the group Women Against the Budget is created, and this feminist group would draw hundreds of women to its regular, highly charged meetings. Out of all of this, a Lower Mainland Budget Coalition is formed, and from the July 11th meeting, a six-point resolution is produced, calling for a demonstration and urging the BC Federation of Labor to initiate a province-wide protest. A march and rally is scheduled 12 days later on July 23rd in Vancouver.
On July 15th, the BC Federation of Labor convenes a meeting with representatives from all of the province's unions, including their historical rival unions, who had had a history of raiding each other, and announces the formation of Operation Solidarity, an alliance of 500,000 union members representing 37% of the entire workforce of British Columbia. Some of the spicy rhetoric that you might have heard at this meeting includes the head of the Hospital Employees Union announcing that they were prepared to fight in the streets, and a telecommunications workers union rep who says he believes a general strike possibly in October is virtually a certainty. Within 3 weeks, $1.5 million is raised for Operation Solidarity, and all but 200,000 of that came from within British Columbia.
There's also a workplace occupation that happened. So on July 19th, the government called union rep Gary Steeves to a meeting in Vancouver and told him that the Tranquil Home for 325 disabled people in Kamloops would close, putting 600 BCGEU members out of work without following union contract layoff rules. And this was before Bill 3, which I talked about a little bit earlier, had even become law. And what Steeves did is he got on a plane to Kamloops right away, he held a mass membership meeting, and the workers supported the idea of taking over the facility themselves. This is not an idea that was without precedent within British Columbia. In a strike against BC Tel about 3 years earlier, I think, the members of the Telecommunication Workers Union had actually taken over their workplaces. So basically, the workers put together a makeshift BCGEU Tranquil NFL flag, and they occupied the facility for 22 days. Their bosses, including the general manager, were holed up in another building. They continued to sign off on expenses, including wages, and as well as a $350,000 replacement for an air conditioner of the cerebral palsy unit. Steve's basically threatened management to sign off on expenses or things would get worse, which is really, really cool. And I think a great strategy, especially considering that our current government in Alberta is trying to do the exact same thing in privatizing and closing homes for people with disabilities.
On the 18th of July, a meeting of the Lower Mainland Budget Coalition drew some 450 activists from 150 groups and unions, and rallies of around 1,000 and 6,000 took place in cities like Kamloops and Victoria. And then on July 23rd, between 20,000 and 30,000 people gathered at BC Place in Vancouver, demanding the withdrawal of the entire legislative package. Where was organized labor in all of this? Well, the president of the BC Federation of Labor was a man by the name of Art Cube. And as we mentioned, he launched Operation Solidarity about a week before the July 23rd.
Does the Alberta Advantage. Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger showcasing your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Every week since February 2025, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist, Rachel Gilmore, breaks down the main headlines so you don't have to doom scroll on Bubble Pop. On this highlight from a new episode, Rachel sits down with extremism expert Amarnath Amarasingham and Queer Momentum's Faye Johnstone to talk about the Tumblr Ridge tragedy, youth radicalization, and transphobia. Now, here's the show.
Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop. This is the weekly live show where we talk about some of the biggest headlines and juiciest news tidbits so you don't have to doom scroll. And if you want to support the show, you can do that on Patreon, Substack, YouTube, as well as anywhere you'd like to listen. While we're live, we're also going to leave about 10 minutes at the end of the episode where you can ask some questions. I'm going to prioritize people who use the super chat function, but I will take, we always have time for some normal questions as well. So please don't be shy. Drop those in the chat. All right, let's get into it. This has been a hard week. Which means that this is going to be a bit of a hard episode. We're going to dig into some uncomfortable, painful stuff. And if that doesn't feel right for you, please don't feel bad. You can skip this one. I'll see you next week, okay? See, when I initially planned this week's episode, I had wanted to talk about youth far-right radicalization. There had been a teen in the Quebec City area who was recently charged with a terrorism-related offense. According to the RCMP, he had allegedly been making propaganda for the militant accelerationist neo-Nazi terror group Adam Offen. But then something truly unthinkable happened. In the small BC community of Tumblr Ridge, an 18-year-old shooter opened fire on a school and over the course of the incident took the lives of six kids and two adults. It really is devastating. I think we all struggle to just look at the pictures of these sweet kids and it's heartbreaking. I think our whole country is mourning right now and thinking of Tumblr Ridge. And as if this cruelty, this unbearable pain wasn't enough, some people immediately took this news for their own agenda and used it, twisted it to vilify and demonize the transgender community. And it wasn't just fringe Twitter accounts. It included major newspaper columnists, elected politicians, influencers who had recently been invited to the Conservative convention. All of it, a cruel and selfish distraction from what actually matters, which is the victims, their families, and their community. Today, we are going to talk about all of this, which is why I say it's not going to be an easy episode. youth radicalization and the danger it poses, misinformation in times of crises, and vicious transphobia. To help me do that, I've got two incredible guests on the show today, and I am extra grateful for them this week because these conversations are not easy at all. So the fact that they were willing to do this, I'm truly grateful. Amarnath Amarasingham is an associate professor at Queen's University and is a senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. He's written several books on, and his study of extremism and radicalization has seen him directly interview members of major international extremist groups, as well as their friends and families. Faye Johnstone is an iconic tour de force who is doing some heavy lifting in saving our world. She's the executive director of Queer Momentum, a nonprofit advocacy organization powering queer political action across Canada. She was also, you may have heard, once on a chocolate bar, which made the worst people in the world really, really angry. She's probably your least favorite person's least favorite activist. Amar, Faye, welcome to Bubble Pop.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks for being here. You know, this really has been an awful week. And I wanted to start off by just giving you both the chance to share how you're doing. I think that this is something that is both, you know, it's one of those moments that I think we all feel on this community level and on a deeply personal level. So Amar, I'll start with you. How are you feeling after seeing the news this week? What was your first reaction and what really kind of hit home to you about this story?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for doing this and thanks for having this conversation. I think this is kind of our Sandy Hook moment, right, in Canada in many ways. Like, and I think it's important to note that, like, good people in society, good people in Canada will come together. They will help the families. They will focus on the victims as they've already been doing. And I think good people will already also start to kind of help these kids, kids in general, more broadly. And I was just thinking this morning about how hard it is to be a kid these days, from online bullying to social media addiction to the mainstreaming of kind of anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ content to mental health resources being underfunded and whittled away. And now you have kind of their physical safety not really guaranteed either. So the kids need help, and I think the good people in society will do what they can. And then you have the rest, who I think will, as we've also been seeing, unfortunately, politicize every single aspect of the shooting, as they have from whether it's guns to trans identity to mental health issues. And I've even seen things like video games and the shooter's anime interests, I guess. It's just this bizarre exhausting ability for them to kind of see everything through the lens of us and them, through the prism of kind of a culture war framing. I just think they're the people that we need to support and pay attention to will do what's necessary. And then all this vile kind of swampy behavior, luckily confined largely to the internet, can be pushed to the side.
Yeah. And just to jump off of what Amar said, there are really helpful resources out there, like and it doesn't make you weak or anything to use them. When I was a teenager, I actually had something happen in my life and I called Kids Help Phone. And I was crying so hard that the woman couldn't understand me at first. But then she calmed me down and was really helpful. So please, please use those resources. If you're struggling, they're there to help. Faye, how about you? How are you doing? What stood out to you? How are you holding up?
You know, I think I haven't been able to stop thinking about the families and the victims, right? Like, I think I can't imagine what that community, what Tumblr Ridge is going through. It's a small community, right? It's a close-knit community. And I've been reeling. You know, I think folks across Canada woke up on Wednesday feeling a little bit less safe and knowing that, like, that illusion of safety that I think many of us have relied on in Canada, in contrast to America, right? Like, we've imagined that we're so good, we're so safe. That was shattered overnight. And that's actually what I haven't been able to move past. You know, there's the folks that Amar referred to who are, you know, making political hay out of this. But I'm still like in that moment of like wrangling with a shattered illusion. And I think a lot of Canadians are too. You know, we're going to get to the point where we have to like figure out what happened here, where we have to think about, you know, mental health supports for kids, where we have to think about, you know, polarization and online radicalization and everything there. And we still don't know more, so much about what's happening here. But I think I want to just like continue to take moments for that grief for the families and the victims. And I want to make sure that we hold central in this, the community of Tumblr Ridge, and do everything that we can as Canadians. Like, this is the moment to show who we are and what we believe. And that is, we reject the vilification of a whole community based off the actions of an individual. We reject a response that comes out of fear. We ground ourselves in a shared humanity with our neighbors. And we think about solutions that are grounded in evidence so that this kind of nightmare can never happen to any child, to any teacher, to any parent, to any community ever again. And that's really where my thoughts are at. And I wish they could stay there, because there are, you know, the conversation we're going to have today where this is being used in some really heartbreaking ways. But top of mind for me every single morning, every single hour has been that community and have the fact that they deserve better and that those kids need us right now. And we need to address the real factors that led to a crisis like this.
Yeah. So on that note, I mean, there's still a lot that we don't know about this shooting. Really more than anything, what's been striking when it comes to motivation is the amount of mis and disinformation floating around, fake accounts, claims about motivation as a result. Amar, would it be correct to say we're still largely in the dark when it comes to motive and potential pathways to radicalization? Like, what do we know and what don't we know right now?
I mean, in terms of motive, there's basically nothing concrete that hasn't stopped people, as you say, from speculating in all sorts of directions. And this is usually linked to kind of whatever quote unquote issue kind of animates their political life. So if you're an anti-trans activist, that's the only factor that matters. And that's the only factor that you see here. If you're if you hate video games and anime, that's the only factor you see here. And all of these are taken as causal, and the same thing with mental health issues, actually. So I noticed this time and again after attacks, people kind of have a desperate need for causality and closure, and a single cause is often the most satisfying, the most psychologically satisfying for people. We can place kind of the attacker in a box, and it's usually a box that we already hate, you know, surprise, surprise, and then we can move on from that, right? And so they're trans, they have a Muslim name, they have an immigrant name, you know, they were on anime forums and video games or whatever, right? And so it's psychologically satisfying to kind of pin something and then have that as the all explanatory factor. And what we know from decades of research in the space is that's never the case, right? It's never one thing that's going to be the thing. And structural explanations like, you know, long-term grievance, ideology, and I'm not saying there was an ideology here, we have no idea. Social isolation, they tend to be slow and messy and uncomfortable, you know, something like the lack of mental health resources in rural parts of Canada, you know, that's not really a sexy causal mechanism for violence. And so, and we know he was seen by police numerous times for mental health calls and even detained under the Mental Health Act and so on. So the structural explanations are never satisfying. So people always go to these kind of flamboyant topics to kind of as explanatory factors. And that's usually leads nowhere.
Yeah. It's a difficult thing, right? And the lack of information, which is frankly, in many ways, the responsible thing right now, you know, law enforcement shouldn't be jumping to conclusions, leaves a void because people have that desire for answers. And then we have an information ecosystem where a lot of bad faith people are willing to fill that void right now, you know, with their preferred vilification, their preferred, you know, political agenda. And it's really gross to see. You know, I'm just going to follow up with Amar quickly here, and then I want to bring Faye in. But just on the question of this radicalization and, you know, the how the shooter was, she was only 18. And, you know, the victims were even younger. It was at a school. I mean, I think a lot of Canadians feel a bit shocked that this happened here because we're so used to seeing these headlines out of the United States. Amar, were you surprised that this happened here? Are there conditions for young people right now that are contributing to, like, is there an increase in youth radicalization that we're seeing right now that helps you to explain this to some degree? Obviously, we don't know the motivation here. But I guess, were you surprised to see this happen in Canada?
I was not. I mean, I think living, as you say, like living